Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, this is Suzanne Toro, and are you awake now, Mike?
Yes, I'm here.
I don't know if you could hear that. That was really loud. I have Mike Zuckerman here with me, and he is with Third Spaces. Mike, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Suzanne.
And you're in sunny, I understand, San Francisco right now?
Yes, we're having a rare summer heat wave in San Francisco. At 100 degrees in the bay yesterday, so I've been spending a lot of time on the water.
Nice. Well, after the cool summer, I'm sure everyone wanted to be outside enjoying the heat.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to, speaking of summer, since you've been away actually all summer, pretty much, when did you head to Africa? Because I wanted to talk to you today. We saw each other very quickly in San Francisco, and you shared a little bit of your journey, and I would like you to share with the listeners a little bit, a summary. I know it's hard to condense 40 days into a soundbite, but if you could share the highlights and, you know, what took you to Africa and where what you walked away with.
Sure. Well, I had the privilege of being sent to Kampala, Uganda, during the 2010 World Cup that was hosted in South Africa. And the idea was to share the games of the World Cup with those in Africa who are less fortunate. So we brought a giant projection screen and a sound system and all the audiovisual equipment needed to be able to show the games of the World Cup for free to a slum of Kampala called Chebando. And the result was we'd get hundreds and sometimes over 1,000 people coming together to watch the games. And each halftime, I would give a talk about the sustainable movement and about community building and then turn the microphone over to the community and ask them for anything that they'd like to share or challenges that they think are in their community and ideas to come up with solutions. Because with many people, you can make quick work. And it was really just this great energy around the World Cup. I mean, everyone was buzzing. And so to provide this great viewing area in an area where that doesn't have a lot of television and certainly doesn't have things that are offered for free, it was really incredible to see the community come alive.
Beautiful. And what, when you talk about, you know, asking the community what their challenges were, how were they receptive to, A, the concept of sustainability and what they felt were their most immediate challenges they faced on a daily basis?
Sure. Well, like I said, just getting soccer and entertainment in there automatically opens them up to all sorts of different discussions. I was the only Mzungu, it means a white person, in Chebando, and it's a pretty large area, but within the second day, I was already pretty well known as the Mzungu, the white person, who showed up with the screen for the World Cup, and they were really appreciative. So I think that already, by providing something for them, instead of asking for their participation in these sustainable things, I think just starting out with offering this gift really helped them to say, okay, we'll listen to what this guy has to say. And I really didn't try to push an agenda of which challenges we should conquer. I think that they're pretty apparent. When you walk around, there's trash and garbage absolutely everywhere. The government has not picked up trash in Kampala, even though it's the capital city of Uganda, and it's a city of about 1.5 million people. 75% of it is slums, and the government does not pick up trash in the slums. So that 75% of the city, of this huge city, has no sanitary services provided. So it didn't take, you know, an environmentalist to see that that was a problem and a challenge that desperately needs a solution. But I think that there wasn't a lot of consciousness around plastic there, that I would constantly ask vendors, when I would buy something that came in plastic, if they had a bin to throw it in. And they would just laugh at me and say, a bin, what do you need a bin for? Just throw it on the ground. So that really, I couldn't just stand there and tell them that plastic was a problem because there was no awareness and consciousness around it. So what we started to do was teach the kids how to make plastic soccer balls out of plastic bags. And in turn, we would compensate them some money that they could earn towards their school fees. And then we'd give those out to the children. So instead of just, you know, telling them how bad plastic was, it was showing them a way that they could use it for good. And, you know, the other main challenge that really kept coming up during the halftime talks was they put in a brand new highway. The roads in Uganda are atrocious. They're potholes that are more like mountains. They fill up with water. They get mosquitoes in them. It's very difficult to drive. They even say the only time you drive straight in Uganda is if you're drunk, because you really have to weave around all of these hills. But to encourage economic development, they've recently put in this brand new highway funded by the European Union called the Northern Bypass in the area that I was in. And that's very helpful for allowing goods to move across the country. But they put this in 9 months ago, right in between the village where I was, and people are getting hit every other day, and children mostly, who are going to school, because they just put this road in, and right in the middle of a village. So although plastic is an issue, and as an environmentalist was what I was most interested in tackling, I had to listen to what they were saying during the open mic portions of the halftime talks, and that meant that we really decided to work towards a solution to making the highway less deadly.
And when you worked on that solution, were they an integral part of developing that solution, or how did you guys arrive at that solution? And
sure,
share with us what it was.
Yes, absolutely everything was done as a community. There's 16 different overlapping jurisdictions and all these different politicians and police and schoolmasters and all these different things. So yes, that was one of the things that I took away, is you have to ask the local chief before you do anything. And that was the LC chairman, the local council chairman, was very receptive to all of these ideas, and they were really excited about the concept of leveraging the World Cup to build community and start these programs that can continue. And with regard to the road, the deadly road, we originally went to the police station because the people that live near the road and work near the road said they're tired of seeing blood there. And there are no signs there's even signs further up the road that say animal crossings, but there's no signs for children crossing. And there's no pedestrian bridge. There's no speed bumps. It's just this really, really dangerous situation. So we formed a group called the Chibando Green Age, and they came up with that themselves. And this was a committee that we decided, we saw that all this community action was happening during the World Cup. In order to have some organization and structure behind it, we decided to form a committee based at the local chairman's office. And this was where we decided to come up with all the different strategies of how to tackle this road situation. And we first went to the police, and we confirmed that the number of people that are killed there is the greatest of anywhere in the entire country. They call it a black spot, this one intersection between Chibando and Kisalasalo. And then we went to the Uganda National Road Authority, which is the government agency which is responsible for the roads, and we saw that their mission was to provide safe, environmentally friendly roads that encourage economic development. So we didn't go in there and yell at them. We went in there and said, hey, we want to help you achieve your mission because this road is not safe. And we also went to the construction company that makes the road to find out how much it would be to make a pedestrian bridge, to find out how much it would be to survey the signs. And we also went to a lot of the different school headmasters to find out what their thoughts were on this road, and it was unanimous that everyone saw it as a huge problem, and a lot of schools were even seeing enrollment drop because parents were afraid to send their children across the road. So that was kind of the main beginning was going to talk to all of the stakeholders. But then we also took some action on our own, where we simply just bought a child crossing sign and started to play crossing guard ourselves. And we got together about 1,700 students and community leaders, and on my final day in Uganda, we stopped traffic on the highway and held a press conference with the police, with the Uganda National Road Authority, with politicians, headmasters, and it was really a tremendous gathering. I mean, to get 1,700 people together to stand up for their rights, basically, that's what it turned into. It wasn't just building community. It's saying, hey, these are our rights. You're killing our children, you're killing our future, and we have all these other problems that are very difficult, like malaria and AIDS. How can we let something so simple as a crossing guard or a sign or a bridge also take children from us?
Great. Wow, beautiful. And describe a little bit more of the feeling of community there versus what maybe someone in North America perceives or participates in community, how it's different.
Yeah, well, I think mobilization is much easier there because there are a lot of problems. And I think that action, human action, follows either crisis or inspiration. And I think that it's difficult to get people to respond to something if the crisis is not apparent. And in Uganda, there are many, many crises, and they're very apparent. So whereas here sometimes in North America we say, yeah, things could be better. Should I go attend this fundraiser? Should I open my wallet to help this cause out? You know, everything's pretty good for my family. But in Uganda, things are not so good for their families. They're having trouble finding work. They're having trouble, keeping their children healthy because there's disease in the street. So when there's an idea to catalyze around, people really mobilize. And the other thing is that people kind of stay very local. So the method of promotion there is you just do a drive where you get a truck, you load it up with speakers, you get a microphone and music, and you just drive around, make a couple of laps, and tell them, hey, we're going to be watching the World Cup game here, or hey, we're going to be cleaning up the streets, hey, we're going to stop traffic on the road. And all you have to do is do this drive, and it only costs about $30 to make a drive, and then you can really get the whole community to show up. So I think that there is a very strong community, and everyone knows each other. They've all stayed in, they grew up in the same place, they live together, and they really do respect their elders as well. So if you can get the elders on board, you and the local politicians, you can really get mass mobilization. And I was just so excited. I've been part of a lot of different protests and rallies here in America and San Francisco. The largest of which was when the Chinese Olympic torch came through San Francisco, and I got to participate with some of the Ruckus Society people and get to see how they do it, and it was really amazing. But it takes a global event like an Olympic torch coming through to really catalyze a community to stand up for something. Whereas in Uganda, I feel you can really just do a drive, get a marching band, kind of get a few of the right people riled up, and boom, people are ready to respond.
And with seeing that, how can you come back to North America, or how would you, now that you're here and spent some time integrating back, do you feel that you could inspire that community here, and especially with your company, Third Spaces, in a different way than maybe before you left to Uganda?
Most definitely. And that was part of the main reason of going was, one, I thought it would be a lot of fun. I thought it would be helpful. But two, I really wanted to understand a different perspective on the concept of the third space. And the third space is the concept that in society, people spend time firstly in their home as their first space, work as a second space, and the third space is the social community space. And that's the area that I like to focus on, because when people are outside of home and work, is really where new ideas and movements and revolutions have historically come out of. And it's also, you know, it's where you're having fun. And there are third spaces everywhere in society throughout civilization, whether it be the, you know, local place where the stories were told, or whether it's a stadium or a bar or a nightclub or a coffee shop. Society always has these places where people can interact with each other without the constructs of home and work. And I don't have a full understanding. I've only been back for a little bit less than a month, and I don't have a full understanding of exactly how I'm going to take what I've learned in Africa and apply it to my third space concept here, because it's so different. But the overarching concepts of really how important it is, it's been reinforced to me that if we can gather people for an entertaining purpose, you really can inject any sort of consciousness around any sort of issue that is important to bring out. And that's the importance of technology, that I could show up there with an inflatable screen and bring my laptop, that I could do presentations with all sorts of different imagery, and even just showing them Google Maps of their village. They'd never seen that before. And the, you know, it's almost, you know, you're showing up like a magician in a way, and the, you know, suspension of disbelief that people are entertained, and you're really able to use this as a means of getting people's attention. And I think that, you know, the missionaries were very successful in spreading religion, and I think that we have an opportunity now in society to spread a new message of oneness and of the importance of self-sufficiency and in the importance of community. And I think that by leveraging the third space and audiovisual technology and presentations, you know, we have an opportunity to kind of become modern missionaries. But our message is not one of a specific religion. It's more a message of spirituality and community and togetherness.
And when you were speaking, something just hit me, because you talk about, you know, being the magician and showing them things that they did not realize maybe existed or were there. And I think actually the same occurs here in North America or other parts that are developed nations, that depending on our environment, what we receive and what we know, especially around sustainability and environment, we are kept somewhat in the dark. So would you say that maybe that's an area that you could shed light in North America on issues that they maybe aren't getting all the information, and open up a discussion, and that in itself might inspire some movement, swifter movement?
Yes, I mean, most definitely. There's entertainment. It doesn't have to be something I've never seen before, but anytime you're able to entertain people, you can get a crowd. And anytime you have a crowd, you have an opportunity to get a message across. So I'm really inspired by, there's a number of groups out there. There's one called Reverb that is working with Adam Gardner. It's working with musicians to help instill consciousness amongst their audiences. And that's central to the third space concept, is show people a good time and then, you know, see what happens. And again, just like I didn't show up to Uganda with my own ideas of what has worked here in San Francisco at Temple Nightclub and at other venues and try and bring that to Uganda, I really showed up and just said, hey, here's the screen, here's the entertainment, now it's up to you guys, what are we going to do? And I think that that's the central message is, and that's really the Peace Corps model, is to ask them what their challenges are. And even though this wasn't sanctioned through the Peace Corps or anything like that, I think it was incredibly successful because we identified a partner where we could screen the games. And I plan on doing this for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, and even trying to expand some of the programs that we started in Uganda and continue them and see what we can do over the next 4 years before the Brazil World Cup starts.
Beautiful. And these soccer balls that you mentioned them to me when we met, and I'm still inspired by them. What do you think how could that continue from what you did there? I don't know. I kept feeling them maybe coming to North America. And do you have any inspirations or any more thoughts on what had occurred with the plastic soccer balls?
Yeah, the balls really stand out as a white person. A lot of people were asking me for money, and I'm, you know, spending money on doing this community building with the game, but it was for the children, it was for the community. So I would ask people, if, when they ask me for money, I'd say, make me a soccer ball and I'll buy it for you from you. And I had one gentleman who said that he was drinking too much, he wasn't sure if he'd be able to pay his rent, he's really just not in a good place in his head, and he wanted, you know, some money. I said, hey, make me a soccer ball. And he came back with the most beautiful soccer ball. All the other ones we'd seen were kind of tied plastic bags and, you know, just looked like they'd fall apart right away. He made this beautifully handcrafted, you know, good design that we could replicate and it would last a while. And that kind of launched this Bovera ball project. The word for plastic is, plastic bag is called Bovera in Uganda. And so we started calling them Bovera balls. And then on the weekends, we would gather plastic during the week from all these different stores and places and get all their clean plastic. And we would get huge bags, I mean, full trucks full of plastic. And then we'd get the children there, and we'd teach them how to make these balls that Isaac was the gentleman who made these first ones. And we would show them how, and then we would give them string. And at the end of the day, we would buy them from them for about 40 cents, which is 1,000 shillings. And we've, again, started to put those fees or the money that they're earning from the balls towards their school fees. And if there's one or two things that are ubiquitous throughout the developing world and pretty much the globe, it's plastic and it's soccer. So we're really excited about the prospects of, again, teaching them that plastic can be used for something else. Also, it's giving out toys. Kids there are playing soccer with rocks. They're playing soccer with empty water bottles, anything. So to be able to have these, you know, hundreds of balls that we could give out to the community, it's really, you're giving out smiles, you're giving out toys, and it's really one of the most incredibly rewarding things you could possibly imagine. And each ball costs about 40 cents. So we've been able to work together with some partners in North America that are sponsoring balls. You know, we get a $100 donation that can fund, you know, that can fund buying, you know, 100 balls, you know, or I'm sorry, that can fund buying, you know, close to 200 balls. And that's 200 balls that we're giving an activity for the children to work together. We're teaching them a skill. They're cleaning up their environment. And then we're giving out this toy and at the same time helping them earn fees for education. So it kind of just came together like that. It was not intended before we got there. But I think of all the projects that started, this is the one, the Bovera Ball Project, that has the potential to scale across India and Brazil and China, and potentially even working with schools in North America and children to show them how to make the balls out of plastic as well. Because we really don't have a great solution for plastic bags, and they've kind of invaded not just the developing world, but the developed world as well.
Nice. And do you have images of these balls? I would love to have them for a post past this radio cast. And if people want to celebrate or support this project, where can they get in contact with you?
Sure. Well, I definitely have a lot of pictures. I have a lot of video. I'm still working on condensing it into a shorter presentation. But the web address for the Bovera Ball Project is boveraballproject.posterous.com. The shortened link is tinyurl.com/plasticwc, as in Plastic World Cup. So that will take you to the same site, and you'll get to see some of the images. There's a place to donate. We're still developing it there and showing some of the Uganda partners. But the labor in Uganda is only about $2.20 a day. So we're still able, to the money that we raised during the World Cup, able to employ about four different Ugandans after the World Cup. One of them is a crossing guard. One of them is the Bovera Ball instructor. And two of them are kind of helping manage the pictures and administration needed to keep these projects going. But anything really helps. And we're definitely making this as a model. UNICEF is very interested in funding it for Brazil 2014, as I mentioned. So, it was really just an amazing summer, and I was kind of looking for a new experience and, you know, a way to to help take whatever I've done here in America and share with it with the people of Uganda, but really I got so much more from them. And as I said when I left there, that I may be leaving Africa, but Africa will never leave me. It really was a life-changing experience, and just felt so productive and inspired and welcomed, and I, you know, can't wait to continue to do this work for the rest of my life.
Beautiful. And I love your openness as you took your journey into Uganda, not to have really any expectations or an agenda to drive and look at what arrived at your footsteps, a plastic soccer ball. And also a little leadership position, or not so little bit of a leadership position. And before we wrap up, I would like you just to briefly share you have Third Spaces and all the work that you do in San Francisco, and what you feel your immediate direction will be. You and I have talked in the past about being prepared for disaster, and how that works hand in hand with sustainability. Can you just share kind of a brief overview what your vision is for that?
Sure. Well, the main thing that I'm focusing on with Third Spaces in San Francisco is that San Francisco has a current rate of 72% diversion from landfill, and we're trying to get to zero waste by 2020. They just passed a mandatory law which requires all businesses and homes to sort their waste into recycling, compost, and trash. And it's a law. I mean, San Francisco is really on the cutting edge of this area. And I do believe that waste is very closely tied to behavior and therefore, can shape our actions. And so I'm very interested in focusing on bars, nightclubs, and restaurants being the sector that will lead the city in compliance with this new ordinance, because they're the ones that stand to save the most money because they make food, they sell food and drinks. So that's kind of what Third Spaces is up to in San Francisco, is this bar, nightclub, restaurant waste sorting policy. I think that's kind of the gateway towards this message we were talking about earlier of oneness and togetherness and community and understanding that what you do to hurt something else or someone else also hurts yourself, and it also what you do to help someone else or something else also helps yourself. And this notion of community, like I'm heading out to Burning Man next week, and people build their own cities, or they build an entire city in the time in a week. And if your neighbor has a problem with their tent during a windstorm, you go and help them. Whereas I feel in cities now, we're kind of a little bit isolated, that we don't know our neighbors. And that's one of these things that disasters, as I mentioned before, action follows crisis and inspiration. Sure, we can respond to a crisis, and we've shown time and time again that we can and that we do. But the goal is to inspire people, and that's why I'm focusing on these venues, to get people together. There's simple things, like during an earthquake, which is very possible to happen in San Francisco, you don't run outside, you stay put. And messages like that, convey those to the patrons at these bars, nightclubs, and restaurants, kind of give them the cliff notes for disaster preparedness. It's not something that we have to keep doing every day. Once we get prepared, we're set. We're ready to go. Sure, we have to do refresher courses, but I really believe in a community that is well prepared for a disaster is a strong community that can tackle all sorts of other issues. And what's more important than making sure that ourselves, our family, and our friends are going to be safe? And there's a ton of outdoors people here in the Bay Area that really take pride in being able to handle themselves in the woods. So. I'm in the neighborhood emergency response team, so in case of a disaster, I know my place to report to triage, but I'm trying to share that with, the community at large. And, any places where we can get together and talk about these things and figure out what we can do is all positive steps towards a strong community, and a strong community can do anything.
I couldn't agree more. Well, Mike, I really appreciate your time, and also appreciate everything that you're doing from other continents to your own homeland. And if anyone wants to support any of the things or get involved that Mike is involved in, Mike, share the best place to connect with you is via Third Spaces website. Is that the best way?
Yeah, or even just an email. I love talking to people. I'm great with email. You can email me at zuck.mike@gmail.com. So that's zuck.mike@gmail.com.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for all you do. And I know a community has a big heart for you and a special spot and probably wants you to come back really soon.
But we're going to do a one-year anniversary.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. All right. Well, you have a beautiful day. And all, for all of you listening, thank you for listening. And please keep your eyes and ears open for Mike Zuckerman and all the beautiful things that he's bringing for the planet. And think about community, entertainment, and conversation. Have a great day, Mike.
Thank you,
ma'am. Okay. I'm going to just hold 1 second.